Happy Easter to you. This is the weirdest Easter for me, as we're all sheltering in place, that we're not celebrating in person together on this important weekend. But perhaps we can take some of that weirdness we feel into the first Easter story as we recall it. Sometime this morning, in the wee hours 2,000 years ago, when there was just enough light to safely walk around but not enough light to be seen, Mary Magdalene makes this disorienting discovery. She wanted to tend to Jesus' body since he was entombed a day and a half ago on Friday night. After a terrible Saturday, crying, grieving, worrying, and feeling afraid about who would be coming after her and the other disciples, she comes to Jesus' burial cave, only to find a door open and the body missing. Her first thought was that someone has stolen the body. Maybe Jesus' enemies, maybe the government, she didn't know who. So she ran back to tell the disciples who were still in hiding, and that began their investigating and theorizing about what was afoot. Having to worry about grave robbers with all the mystery and intrigue was the last thing they needed with the weekend they just had. They were busy grieving Jesus' death, their beloved teacher and friend, fearing their own fate, and they were also grappling with how following Jesus was not supposed to end like this. Maybe some of us can relate. Whatever we were planning and looking forward to 4 or 5 weeks ago, it was not this wrench of a global health crisis, disrupting our lives so thoroughly, so threateningly. And I think about elderly folk like my parents in their 80s who have suffered and lived through and survived all sorts of perilous things in their lives. They were looking forward to a peaceful last chapter of their life, working through a bucket list of happy things, only to find themselves in a lockdown, trying to dodge an invisible assassin. For the disciples, at some point, I imagine someone recalled all the times Jesus talked about dying and rising from the dead. Or did no one remember any of that? Until the resurrected Jesus showed up in person, and they got to see and feel the wounds on his body. Understandably, they couldn't possibly have known that when Jesus talked about rising from the dead, he meant that literally. They probably thought it was some sort of philosophical or poetic musing, even though some of the disciples have seen Jesus resurrect Lazarus from the dead. That's our passage today in John 11. It was the occasion when Jesus said one of the I am statements in the Gospel of John, the last in our sermon series. The Lazarus stories in John 11 has a special function in John's Gospel. It's there as a bookmark between most of Jesus' 3 years of ministry and the last week, which is the Easter events. Lazarus' story is a teaser to the big climax of Jesus' own resurrection. And it's just before raising Lazarus when Jesus declares, "I am the resurrection and life." And then he proves it by giving life to a dead Lazarus for our benefit, so there would be no doubt that he is creator, the source of all life. Here's how the message tells the story. John 11. A man was sick. Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. This was the same Mary who massaged the Lord's feet with aromatic oil and then wiped them with her hair. It was her brother Lazarus who was sick, so the sisters sent word to Jesus, "Master, the one you love so very much is sick." When Jesus got the message, he said, this sickness is not fatal. It will become an occasion to show God's glory by glorifying God's Son. Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. But oddly, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed on where he was for 2 more days. After the 2 days, he said to his disciples, "Let's go back to Judea." They said, Rabbi, you can't do that. The Jews are out to get you, kill you, and you're going back? Jesus replied, are there not 12 hours of daylight? Anyone who walks in daylight doesn't stumble because there's plenty of light from the sun. Walking at night, he might very well stumble because he can't see where he's going. He said these things and then announced, our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep. I'm going to wake him up. The disciples said, Master, if he's gone to sleep, he'll get a good rest and wake up feeling fine. Jesus was talking about death, while the disciples thought he was talking about taking a nap. Then Jesus became explicit. Lazarus died, and I'm glad for your sake that I wasn't there. You're about to be given new grounds of believing. Now let's go to him. That's when Thomas, the one called the twin, said to his companions, come along, we might as well die with him. When Jesus finally got there, he found Lazarus already 4 days dead. Bethany was near Jerusalem, only a couple of miles away, and many of the Jews were visiting Martha and Mary, sympathizing with them over their brother. Martha heard Jesus was coming and went out to meet him. Mary remained in the house. Martha said, Master, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. Even now I know whatever you ask God, he will give you. Jesus said, your brother will be raised up. Martha replied, I know he will be raised up in the resurrection at the end of time. You don't have to wait for the end. I am, right now, resurrection and life. The one who believes in me, even though he or she dies, will live. And everyone who lives believing in me does not ultimately die at all. Do you believe this? Yes, Master. All along I have believed that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, who comes into the world. After saying this, she went to her sister Mary and whispered in her ear, the teacher is here and is waiting for you. The moment she heard that, she jumped up and ran out to him. Jesus had not yet entered the town, but was still at the place where Martha had met him. When her sympathizing Jewish friends saw Mary run off, they followed her, thinking she was on her way to the tomb to weep there. Mary came to where Jesus was waiting and fell at his feet, saying, Master, if only you'd been here, my brother would not have died. When Jesus saw her sobbing and the Jews with her sobbing, a deep anger welled up within him. He said, where did you put him? Master, come and see, they said. Now Jesus wept. The Jews said, look how deeply he loved him. Others among them said, well, if he loved him so much, why didn't he do something to keep him from dying? After all, he opened the eyes of a blind man. Everybody is asking why. The sisters, the friends, and neighbors is a perfectly reasonable question. Jesus' behavior is downright odd for someone who loves Lazarus. And for someone who is in a position to do something to spare his life and the suffering of the people who loved Lazarus. My first internship as a pastor was for a student group in UBC. One day I got a phone call from the hospital telling me one of the students had been in a car accident. The lady on the phone said he asked for me. Then in her serious voice, she said, he should come. I did what you would have done, drop everything and get to the hospital. Jesus, we're told, dawdled. Jesus is sort of in hiding. So the disciples just assume Jesus isn't going to risk his own life to save someone, not even a good friend. But then, after 2 days, Jesus announces his time to hit the road. Even though he tells his disciples he knows Lazarus has died already. It's all very confusing. So Jesus will risk his life by stepping out of hiding, but not when Lazarus most needed him. And then now it seems to everyone that it's too late. Maybe some of us have learned this very well already. God's agenda, it's often different than ours. God's timetable is different than ours. Jewish people take grieving very seriously, and there's a proper way to do it. This includes abstaining from pleasurable things for a whole year. On the day someone is entombed, the village will come together around the grieving family, bringing food for a meal. This day begins 3 days of very intense mourning. With professional chanters and mourners, the more wealthy a family, the more people they would hire for help to support the proper emotional tone of this occasion. In Jesus' time, people believed it takes 3 days for someone to be completely dead. Within 3 days, they still hold out some remote hope that the person's soul is still hanging around and may just pop back into the body. So after 3 days, the outward expression of grief has tempered a little as they begin to accept and cope with the new normal that the person is really gone. For the rest of the week, the family would sit in their house and quietly receive friends and guests as they drop by to express condolences and to offer comfort. This was what Mary and Martha were doing when the word came that Jesus had been spotted on the road to town. It's only a couple of miles from where Jesus was to where Lazarus was, so Jesus could easily have rushed to get to his sick friend. So perhaps chances are by the time the messenger is dispatched to Jesus, by the time he arrives with the message, Lazarus has already died. So there's really no point hurrying. But Jesus really took his time. He arrives 4 days later. There's no doubt by then that Lazarus is completely, really dead. And the sisters are done with the most intense part of the mourning and are now entering the new normal part of the grief, the beginning of facing and accepting the brother is gone forever. And that's when Jesus finally shows up, too late. Martha is the first to run to greet Jesus when she hears he finally come. "If only you'd been here," she says to him. That sounds like a more polite way to say, "Where the blankety blank were you?" What Martha says is bound up in confusion and disappointment. Apparently, she still has no doubt in his power, his ability to heal. She says that to him. And she even believes in his power to do something now, whatever can she be thinking of when Lazarus is completely dead. And she's now fully into that new normal part of her grief. Somehow, this remarkable person has an imagination and a faith in Jesus that reaches far beyond the reality of what she sees and feels and knows. This is amazing to me as a staunch pessimist who is always fixating on the worst case scenario. And this is when Jesus says, "I am the resurrection and the life." John tells us right at the beginning of the gospel what Jesus means. That life comes from God, Father, Son, and Spirit. That everything that exists in the world owe their existence to Jesus, and in him is life and light for all humanity. Now Martha says, "Yes, yes, yes, I know resurrection will happen eventually." Likely, she believes in the kind of resurrection that some rabbis teach. That when someone dies, their soul falls into a kind of restful sleep. Then at some point, God wakes them up at the end of this chapter of human history when the Messiah comes, and they would have some sort of life again. Though they don't exactly know what kind of life. We don't know what she was hinting at when she said she knew God would do whatever Jesus asked. But at this point, it seems to her that Jesus, who comes too late, is not really going to do anything in the here and now. So Martha goes home and sends her sister Mary to go talk to Jesus. Maybe she's hoping Mary can sweet talk Jesus into doing more because Jesus seems to have a soft spot for Mary. And you wonder if Martha may have coached Mary on what to say because she says exactly what Martha says. "If only you were here." Same words. But Mary got to Jesus. John says Jesus was visibly moved in spirit and troubled. The message, understand this to mean Jesus was angry, and then Jesus wept. The language here is not like in American movies when the camera gets enclosed and a solitary tear rolls down the side of the hero's face. Jesus is full on howling and wailing. Jesus cries the gut-wrenching way men do in Korean movies, if you've seen that. Over and over again in gospel stories, we see that Jesus is not pragmatic. Just because he knows the end of the story, how things will work out to a happy ending, doesn't make the middle of the story hurt less. He is God who feels our pain, like all the times in the Old Testament when God notices and is moved by human suffering, and he's compelled to intervene to deliver rescue, remedy, and set free. Jesus steps into the village in mourning, and he feels each person's loss piled one on top of another. But perhaps Jesus is also pained by a bigger thing than just Lazarus' death. Death is not in God's original design for us when he made us. Neither is war or tsunamis or viruses our bodies don't know what to do with. And seeing what the world has become causes God pain, because what the world has become causes us pain. Jesus is angry the way movie directors are pained and angered when studios take the movies and re-edit it so they would be more commercial. And a masterpiece is ruined by clumsy meddling. Some people see Jesus crying and they just think, well, everybody cries at funerals of someone they love. But then some people are more cynical. They wonder how much he really loves Lazarus when he took his sweet time getting to town. For us, death is inevitable. Apparently, death is programmed into our genes. So even if nothing bad happens to us, our bodies will naturally start shutting down at a certain age. The end of Genesis 3 alludes to this. When after Adam and Eve rejected God and instead opted to make life happen on their own, and God in his mercy anticipated the mess we would make of the world, decided to cap off human life in order to limit our suffering. What a reality check we're living through right now. Despite our advances in science and medicine and our confidence in our technology to do anything, like colonizing another planet after ruining this one, it turns out we're just as frail and helpless as ever. All of civilization brought to our knees by a bit of mutant genetic material. Death is unavoidable, and it's awful. I don't think anyone really wants to die unless they're terminally ill and in pain or have some emotional struggles that make living unbearable. I notice that some people romanticize death. Maybe you have heard of YOLO, the acronym for you only live once. So since we all die, they say, what's important is not the length of life, but how much over-the-top adventure we can pack in as long as we are alive. So YOLO people do risky, perhaps even reckless things. And when they die, the friends would say, well, they die doing what they love. Some philosophers say it's death that gives human life meaning. It's what separates us from animals. Since unlike them, we are aware that we will die and life has a definite end, knowing we're temporary makes life more precious. So this should make us treasure life, they say, and live meaningfully while we still have breath. There's a TV show, a reboot of an old popular science fiction series. In the reboot, we discover a robot character has lost his body, and his programming has been kept running in a computer. But what this robot asks, we learn, is to be turned off without any heads up. Because in his quest to experience all things human, the one thing left to know is what death feels like, to know it's coming, to not know when, and then to grapple with that inevitability. It all feels a little bit heady to me. It's hard, especially right now, to buy into death as a positive thing with all the stories we're hearing. Like this doctor in New York City a few weeks ago. He was in charge of organizing his hospital to deal with the pandemic. He was having back-to-back meetings on a very busy day when he got a text saying his elderly dad had been infected and was being ambulanced to a hospital. The doctor couldn't get away to check on his own father, and word came a couple of days later that his dad had died. Very sad, and unfortunately very typical of the awful stories we're hearing from around the world. People get sick, and an ambulance takes them away, but their loved ones cannot follow or visit, and then too many die. And exhausted nurses are having to break the news to families over the phone or the computer and find themselves crying with the bereft many times a day. There's a picture on the internet of long lines in China in front of mortuaries where people queue up to pick up ashes. I don't know how much more of this our collective soul can bear. And a couple of times a day I find myself praying for mercy for our suffering world. Because death is so awful. There are some who are fighting it every inch of the way to not die. There's apparently something called the Avatar Project. These people are working on a technological eternal life of some sort. That by the year 2045, we can live on with the help of computers, with our minds intact as living, sentient holograms. Maybe this is the inspiration behind another storyline in that same rebooted TV show. The 95-year-old hero saves a planet only to die right after from an incurable brain condition. But then suddenly, we find him back to life. Because scientists managed to transfer his consciousness into an artificial body. He was resurrected. But it's such irony that in the same show, immortal things want to experience death and mortal beings want immortality. Or it's maybe just a clever plot twist to keep the show going and avoid a bummer ending. Because nobody wants to die. We don't want to face it, we don't want to see it on TV, and we desperately want a happy ending. A happy ending to this life is the Christian's hope in resurrection. And it's not made up if we believe in the first-hand testimonies that Jesus' tomb was really empty. And all the people who saw Jesus in his new body held his hand, interacted with him, and ate with him. It's not made up if we believe all the people who saw the dead Lazarus given life again. Our hope as Christians is that because Jesus is the God of resurrection and life, and because of his sacrifice of himself to bring us good news, death is not allowed to be the most depressing of bummer endings to our life stories. But there's in fact life beyond death, and the possibility of better life that is pain-free and deathless. Resurrection doesn't spare us of the pain and suffering of loss of loved ones of this life, or our own eventual death, taking us away from this life and the people and things we care about. Death continues to be awful like that. And Christians who expect resurrection may want to be careful about talking callously, as if death doesn't matter, because it still matters. It's still very painful to lose someone. But what Jesus gives us is the promise that this short life is not all of life. And the end is not the end, but a transition to a new life and eventually a new body like the one Jesus had when he resurrected as proof of concept to us, to what we can look forward to. So back in Bethany, Jesus, with everyone disappointed in him and feeling everyone's pain and grief, Jesus asked for directions to where Lazarus is buried. Verse 38, then Jesus, the anger again welling up within him, arrived at the tomb. It was a simple cave in the hillside with a slab of stone laid against it. Jesus said, "Remove the stone." The sister of the dead man, Martha, said, "Master, by this time there's a stench. He's been dead 4 days." Jesus looked her in the eye. "Didn't I tell you that if you believe, you would see the glory of God? Then to the others, go ahead, take away the stone." They removed the stone. Jesus raised his eyes to heaven and prayed, "Father, I'm grateful that you have listened to me. I know you always do listen, but on account of this crowd standing here, I have spoken so that they might believe that you sent me." Then he shouted, "Lazarus, come out." And he came out, a cadaver wrapped from head to toe with a kerchief over his face. Jesus told them, "Unwrap him and let him loose." It's a bit of a trek to the tomb, because burial places tend to be downwind, away from where people live. When Jesus asked for the tomb to be opened, they were reluctant. In the Old English version of the Bible, Martha says, "But Lord, he stinketh." Well, if they were reluctant to even roll the door open, asking for volunteers to go in to bring Lazarus out, I guess was out of the question. So Jesus resorts to yelling into the cave, telling Lazarus to come out. John is really sparse with the details of what happens next. He just leaves us to imagine the awkward logistics. I mean, put yourself in Lazarus' shoes for a moment. How disorienting. I'm sure we all know what it feels like to be awakened from a deep sleep by a loud noise. Once, on my way back from an exhausting missions trip in New Zealand, I fell asleep in the LA airport waiting for my connecting flight. I almost missed my flight. If it weren't for this nice lady who was on the same flight who woke me up. But it was a jarring experience to come to with someone yelling at me saying, "You're going to miss your flight." When I opened my eyes, I had no idea where I was and who this lady was and why she's yelling at me. It must have been even more confusing for Lazarus. Does he even remember dying? Was there a tunnel and a bright light and floating in the air looking down when he shut his eyes for the last time? Or does he just open his eyes and wonder what this dark cave he's in and why he's tied up tight like a mummy? And then he hears a familiar voice yelling at him, calling for him to come out. But how? He's wrapped up like a sausage. He had to roll off the ledge he's on, tumbled onto the ground, wiggle to get up and hop to the opening, and then make his way through like a worm. The instruction to come out is easier said than done. There's no graceful way to do it except to hop and wiggle. John completely leaves us to imagine that the details of that bit of physical comedy. But I think I would find it funny to watch, if it's not just to cut the tension of everything that happened before. Maybe the people watching laugh too, because Lazarus looked ridiculous, and because their mourning had unexpectedly turned into incredible, unimaginable joy. And that moment of extreme high and low emotions changed everything in Lazarus's life and his sister's lives forever and everyone else watching. But not everyone was happy about it. The officials decided Jesus had to die for sure. One of them said it's better for one man to die than a whole nation. He was thinking about losing political power. But little did he know that Jesus' death would lead us to his resurrection and ours, and would radically change everything we think about death. They also wanted Lazarus dead to kill off the evidence of a miracle. So Lazarus, maybe along with his sisters, had to flee Israel by sea. There are two possible trails to where Lazarus ended up. The Eastern Church believes Lazarus ended up in modern-day Cyprus, was appointed a bishop, and lived out his life there. The Western Church believes Lazarus landed in Provence, France, and was appointed the bishop of Marseille. He died again, finally, under Roman persecution of Christians. The resurrection waiting for us is not like Lazarus's. He rose in his same old body, and he eventually died again. The new body Jesus got is the one we're going to get one day, that unlike the body we have now, That one, it's built to last. Resurrection is not the thing that happens after a close call, even though close calls can really change our lives too. My brother almost didn't survive his birth. The doctor had a hard time because my brother got himself tangled up with his umbilical cord 3 times around his neck. At some point, my mom heard the doctor yell out, "Forget it, let's just save the mother." So they put pliers to my brother's head and just yanked them out. To this day, he has a big dent on one side of his head. He used to show it off in elementary school and told everybody he had a horn that was surgically removed. That was a close call. A bit of divine intervention that my family is grateful for, but it's not the same as resurrection. Lazarus was not almost dead or mostly dead. He was completely and thoroughly dead. Resurrection is the thing that happens after we have exhausted all human imagination, possibility, and ingenuity. It's new life and new hope when there's none. Because as Lazarus' sisters point out, anything is possible with God. Resurrection doesn't make death and loss easier or less awful. But Jesus' resurrection on that first Easter Sunday anchors us to the hope-filled certainty that this life is not the whole thing. And then he sets us free from the one thing that most weighed down our life. The certainty of resurrection makes it possible for us to live a full life before we die, despite our frailty and vulnerability as human beings, because we get to tap into a kind of courage and boldness that comes from us leaning into God's Holy Spirit. Our resurrection life is not limited by just what we see with our eyes and feel with our mortal bodies, because through what Jesus has done and our reliance on what he's done, we are already reborn as the children of God. We belong to God. Our new life has already started before we die, with a new body to follow at some point after we die, in a new world without end. So on this Easter Sunday, we celebrate resurrection as God's people of light and love and resurrection hope. Let me finish the I Am series the way we started in John 1. This is the voice translation where Jesus is called the voice. Before time itself was measured, the voice was speaking. The voice was and is God. This celestial word remained ever present with the Creator. His speech shaped the entire cosmos. Immersed in the practice of creating, all things that exist were birthed in him. His breath filled all things with a living, breathing light. A light that thrives in the depths of darkness, blazes through murky bottoms. It cannot and will not be quenched. He entered our world, a world he made, yet the world did not recognize him. Even though he came to his own people, they refused to listen and receive him. But for all who did receive and trust in him, he gave them the right to be reborn as children of God. He bestowed his birthright, not by human power or initiative, but by God's will. The voice took on flesh and became human and chose to live alongside us. We have seen him, enveloped in undeniable splendor, the one true Son of the Father, evidence in the perfect balance of grace and truth. Through this man, we all receive gifts of grace beyond our imagination. You see, Moses gave us rules to live by, but Jesus, the Anointed, offered us gifts of grace and truth. God, unseen until now, is revealed in the voice, God's only Son, straight from the Father's heart.
I know that my comfort this sweet assurance. once was dead. He lives, my ever living head. Lift your eyes, the Savior has arrived. He's alive. He's alive. Saints, arise. Jesus is alive. He's alive. He's alive. Alive. He's alive.